Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome back to the Solari Report, a man who needs no introduction, and certainly in this audience, Jim Norman, veteran reporter, many famous magazines he's written for, Business Week, Forbes, Platts Oil, but someone who commands the most respect for me and our subscribers. He's been with us many times before. I encourage you to go back and listen to the great interviews we've done. His first book, I'm trying to get him to write another one, is called The Oil Card. And we're going to revisit that today and then talk about oil and the politics of oil in the events that are happening today. So, Jim, welcome to the Solari Report. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, hi, Catherine. It's great to be back. I appreciate you having me on again.
Okay, well, as I always say, if you haven't read The Oil Card, you don't understand politics today. So why don't you just, if you could, take us back and recap The Oil Card, what it said, how you came to write it, why it's relevant to what's going on today.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's especially relevant right now because the thesis of this book, which I wrote, it came out in 2008, and it was a pile of string I'd been collecting through a whole career covering oil business. And the thesis of it was this, is that oil pricing is really not a function of physical supply and demand of crude oil. It's not. It's really a geopolitical function. And the United States in particular, and its allies particularly, the Saudis, our guys, are able to actually manage oil prices, even a globally fungible commodity like oil. We can do it. We can pull enough levers and manage things in a way that you can actually move that market out of whack, up or down, for protracted periods of time to either help or hurt other countries. And in particular, the way we broke the Soviet Union was with low oil prices throughout the 1980s. And the book details mechanically how the Reagan and the Bush administrations did that. All the pieces were there, the levers they were able to pull. And it was so dramatically successful that by 1991, the Soviet Union basically ran out of money, turned out the lights, and went away. It was a bloodless destruction of an empire. Oil prices were the key strategic weapon in doing that. And the way we did it is just a masterful study in economic warfare. That's history, and it's all well documented. The pieces are right there. You can go see it. The evidence is right there. And what the book did then was to try and explain why oil prices would be so outrageously high. In 2008, when the book came out, oil prices had risen to like $140 a barrel from, well, barely $10 a barrel 10 years earlier.
Now, I just have to put this in context because I remember reading, you know, what happened to me, Jim, was I went out to dinner and I took your book. I hadn't started it. And I closed down the restaurant because I couldn't stop reading the book. So I was there for the whole evening. But I remember sitting in the candlelight in the restaurant and you had quoted, and I don't remember what year it was, but that Exxon's finding cost sometime in and around there was $4 a barrel. Is that right?
Oh, yes. This is right. I mean,
right.
The actual cost for the major oil companies like ExxonMobil to find, develop, and produce a barrel of oil is ridiculously low. The cost of finding the barrel alone is right now probably less than a dollar a barrel to find reserves in the ground. To develop them, well, say you add another $10 a barrel, and then to produce it, maybe another $5 a barrel. Total cost of getting the stuff out of the ground from beginning to end is still probably less than 20 bucks a barrel for the big guys. And the basic economic rule for commodities is that commodities tend toward glut, and the price tends to fall to the marginal cost of production. That's why you need cartels to keep the price up on these things. Right. In oil and so many other commodities, diamonds, whatever. If you don't have cartels basically restricting production, the price tends to just fall to the marginal cost. If it weren't for a whole bunch of people, entities, trying to keep this lead balloon in the air, oil prices would be far, far lower than they are now. And that's why I wrote the book in 2008. There's no good reason why oil has to be trading over $100 a barrel, let alone $140 a barrel. And lo and behold, in early 2008, right at the time the book came out, the oil price started to drop and drop big. It fell from $140 a barrel. It eventually got down to below $40 a barrel in 2009, or maybe it was late 2008. And that coincided with Russia's invasion of Georgia. The country of Georgia, you remember then, Putin moved forces into Yep. the Republic of Georgia. He still controls one province there, south of Ossetia. But in fact, without any U.S. or NATO military intervention, Putin was persuaded to withdraw his forces and leave Georgia there. He got a token prize there, but he didn't get all he wanted. And he was basically, he went home with his tail between his legs, and oil prices then came back up. And they've hovered in the $100 range ever since. So to me, that was confirmation of the thesis that the U.S. can move oil prices, actually very sharply and in a very short period of time, to affect geopolitical change. And I think that's exactly what you're seeing right now, coinciding with the unrest and the Russian insurrection in Ukraine. You've seen oil prices, global oil prices, tumble by a third, 30% or more.
30% since the summer, and it's been...
Since June, right.
Yeah, quite dramatic.
And they could go much lower. I mean, crude closed today, Tuesday, on the NYMEX at just $74 and change. It could go down to 40 again. There's nothing that would stop it. It could go lower than that, too. People who think that it's miraculously going to stabilize somewhere in between, just out of sheer market forces, are, I think, wildly over-optimistic. If we want to drive this price much lower to hurt Putin's regime, we will. And Putin has basically acknowledged that much. He was quoted in Chinese news media this week. Somebody asked him what he thought about the oil price. He said, well, everybody knows it's a political phenomenon. It's a matter of politics. Of course, there's supply and demand. He said, he's quoted in that. He said, of course, supply and demand have a factor, and low global demand is flagging at the moment. But he said, I think his quote was something like, but sometimes we wonder whether the political forces really are in control here rather than market forces. And he's exactly right. I mean, global oil supply and demand is really in very good balance. In fact, there's no shortage of oil anywhere.
Right.
You could almost describe it as a glut. I mean, inventories are full all over the globe, and
right.
there's plenty of production. We're not running out of oil by any means. But, you know, OPEC is there kind of tweaking production, trying to slow it down a little bit so there's not too much of a glut on the market. The real determinant of oil prices is the New York Mercantile Exchange, the futures market. And there is where prices are really set. The Saudis really just follow the NYMEX in their pricing strategies and their production strategies. They don't control it, and if you listen to their statements, you kind of realize that. They don't know where oil prices are going. They're just looking at the NYMEX. Now, the
right.
NYMEX is controlled strictly by flow of funds in and out of it. Now, when the price was running up, U.S. regulatory activities basically opened the floodgates to an unlimited flow of basically speculative managed money that went pouring into the oil futures market, pretty much heavily dominated on the long side. In other words, it was buying contracts way out on the forward curve. This is not sound business. It's just pure speculation or market manipulation. Now, where that money came from, who knows?
You know, Catherine thinks it comes from the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
I think that's part of it, but that may be just a drop in the bucket. But once the government decides it wants to move that market and starts moving that money, well, all the smart money can see which way the wind is blowing.
Right.
So they all pile on. You know, it's a free ride. And I think exactly the opposite is happening now. I think you see volume is going down on an NYMEX. Open interest is going down. Clearly money is coming out of there. And so you're going to see a stampede of money out of the NYMEX. And so once these price moves up or down start, they tend to get amplified significantly. So I think you could see much more pressure on crude prices over the near term, which is why I think just about every oil man out there who has, you know, built in huge capital spending budgets and built his mansion based on $100 oil, he's thinking, uh-oh, we got cash flow problems, folks, big time. And so
right,
all of the oil
patch. For the oil patch, this is very, very uncomfortable.
This is troubling. This is reminiscent of the 1980s. Now, you remember in the 1980s, oil patch America went bust. I mean, the ground was littered with bankrupt independent oil companies. It was triage out there.
Right.
The major oil companies survived because they've got deep pockets. They could cut their budgets. They had other ways. They could make it up on their refining business, which does fine in times like this. But the independent oil men, the wildcatters, they just got slaughtered. And
right.
George H.W. Bush, there's some interesting stuff in Daniel Yergin's famous book, The Prize, about how Bush, when he was vice president, running for vice president, caught tremendous flack from his buddies in the oil patch. How come you're not doing something about getting these oil prices up? He couldn't say what was going on, but the fact was this was a government national security initiative to basically drive down the price of oil, even at the expense of a whole slew of independent oil men in the United States.
Right.
And that toppled onto the whole S&L debacle, too, when property values fell. You had S&Ls keeling over all over the place. So when you monkey with markets this way, there are all kinds of follow-on effects, many of them unanticipated.
Right.
And I think you could see more of that coming down the road now, too. You saw it in 2008. You know, 2008, the way that year progressed, you started to see some cracks in the mortgage market, housing prices. But it was everybody was whistling past the grave on that. They thought they'd get by. But then the oil prices cracked in the middle of the year and plummeted down. It wasn't soon after that. It was a matter of weeks or months before Lehman failed. Wall Street went into paroxysms of angst, and you began this massive bailout program to try and salvage the financial markets. China just about went bankrupt. They had to go into massive financial defense mode. So when you see a price drop in oil like this, you got to wonder, are there follow-on effects coming?
I want to jump back into the past again, but I should mention, I don't know if you saw David Cameron's speech or article that he published at the end of the G20 meeting in Australia. You know, he's really raising alarm bells, and normally I wouldn't think anything of it, but at the same time you had a series of articles in the British press, including the BBC, announcing new pedophilia scandals. Now, I don't want to get into that, but the reality is, if you look at the way it was done, that is a traditional message that says, do what you are told to do, or you will, you know, be part of the witch hunt here. You know, it was and the combination of Cameron's article and it's pretty, you know, for someone of that stature to come out and ring alarm bells about the global financial system, that's a little strong. So a combination of that and then the sort of wagging the witch hunt said to me, uh-oh, you know, that's a signal that the squabbling is getting pretty fierce. So with a 30% drop in the oil price and then Cameron doing that, I would say there's reason for concern. And clearly you see a lot of deflationary trends in the global economy.
Yeah, and the dollar is going up again quite dramatically, which actually adds to deflationary pressures all over the place. And what you can see happen is every foreign government, every foreign company that has borrowed in dollars, all of a sudden is looking at insolvency, including many of Russia's major corporations, Rosneft. Anyway, they borrowed dollars. Now they can't possibly pay them back. And
right. It's very important. I just want to say this because I know we just had a workshop in California, and what I found was that there's still misunderstanding on this issue. So as quantitative easing has gone on for several years, people around the world have borrowed cheap dollars. So there's been this huge carry trade building up in a variety of places.
Right.
And now, with quantitative easing ending, they've got to pay back in dollars. And there's a fundamental difference between the United States and everybody else. They have to earn their dollars. We can print them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this carry trade has gone on all over the globe now.
Right.
And it's a recipe for disaster. Everybody was betting that the dollar would remain cheap and that the U.S. was going to continue to drive it down, which in many regards it needs to do. The U.S. has just become uncompetitive in a manufacturing sense due to its currency overpricing. And so policy so far, the reason we have zero interest rates in the U.S. is really aimed at trying to lower the value of the currency. But everybody is doing it. The whole world is doing it. It's a global race to the bottom, and it's not working. And in fact, history shows currency wars really never work.
Right.
Nobody can actually get a leg up on anybody else. And what happens is, and this was happened before World War II, is that currency wars ultimately transform themselves directly into trade wars. That when currency manipulation doesn't do the job, countries start to impose restrictive trade barriers, tariffs, non-tariff trade barriers, and then there's retaliation. That's the story behind the whole Smoot-Hawley tariff thing. And the trade wars lead to real wars. So I would bet you within the next year or so, you're going to see emerge on the American political scene an outright people are going to realize they're going to make political hay by talking protectionism. And the public is going to rally to their side. And it's a dangerous recipe because it breeds retaliation globally. So I'm not particularly optimistic on that regard.
Well, let me jump back and do some more history, and then we'll come back to what's going on currently. One of the things I wanted to mention, I was just talking about my visit with Linda Minor this weekend, and one of the things we were discussing is the fact that when we delink the currency from gold, essentially we shifted onto an oil standard. And so, you know, there tends to be a very deep relationship between oil, I think, and the dollar. Would you agree?
Well, you know, I haven't thought that through, but as a de facto matter, I think that's right. My take on it is different than most people. Most people think, the poor United States, we have to wring our hands because we're short on crude oil. No, I don't look at it that way. My viewpoint is the United States actually can consider itself long on crude and basically is indifferent to where prices are. If you consider us as part of a family, the Canadians, the Mexicans, the Saudis, we've got all the crude that we need. We're not exporters of crude. And if crude prices were low, we would be bailing out those neighbor countries anyway, as we did with the Mexicans and the Saudis in the 1980s. So the U.S. is happy to let prices run up, happy to let them run down. We're a rich country. We can afford these prices. In fact, high oil prices have actually spurred tremendous economic activity in the United States with all this fracking stuff. We got wells going everywhere. Production's going up. So, yeah, the United States doesn't have to bankrupt itself to buy oil from abroad.
Right.
Quite the contrary. We make everybody else pay through the nose for it.
Right.
Well, one of the things you go into in the oil carton that we've talked about is how, after what happened in Russia, a real effort was to bring the price up to checkmate the Chinese. That it was one
right.
of the one of there's a dance between sort of busting the Russians and busting the Chinese and trying to maintain.
Right. But this is my thesis in a book that Washington's national security establishment was so impressed with how effective the oil weapon was in defeating the Russians that they decided, well, hey, let's play this in reverse and go after the Chinese. They're big importers. Maybe we can hurt them. If we can drive up their acquisition costs on oil and other raw materials, which they buy in mass, process with cheap labor, and then sell at a loss abroad just to generate hard currency, we could bleed these guys white. And in fact, that's what we've been doing for about the last 10 years. The dirty little secret about China is it really makes no money.
Well, the thing I would point out, before we did that, we went into Russia and did a great deal with our allies to assert control and ownership of the oil Russian reserves. Isn't that the case?
Well, actually, yes, that's true in a sense that I think if you look at companies like Yukos and some of these other oligarch entities, these guys really got the wind in their sails from the West, from the George Soros kind of people who really got them going, helped them assemble all these vast assets from the dregs of the Soviet Union. And Yukos became, you know, would have been Russia's biggest oil company. But when the decision was to move the price up, then we had to restrict production. If you're going to push prices up on the NYMEX, you don't want extra barrels sloshing around in the market. And I've always said, Mikhail Korkovsky, the guy who ran Yukos, his great sin was not threatening to get into politics against Putin. His problem was he wanted to keep increasing production at Yukos and, in fact, build his own pipeline into China. This just did not fit with the program. And the quickest, easiest way to stop that was just to nationalize this company, bust it up, throw all the head people in jail, give it to the Russian company. And what everybody ignores is that in 2003, the Russians and the Saudis sat down and signed basically a market-sharing agreement whereby the Russians agreed to limit their exports to half the daily exports of the Saudis, and that has remained ironclad in place ever since 2003. The Russians could be producing and exporting much more oil, but they've limited to 4.5 million barrels a day, which is half what the Saudis do.
So and that deal is still in effect.
Yes, it is.
Despite the sanctions and all the, you know, blustering, it's still in effect.
That's right, because here's Putin's problem is this. If he were to produce more, he would hurt the price of oil. It's very much in his interest to maintain that agreement to keep the Saudis from overproducing either and keep that agreement in place. This is why this oil price drop hurts Putin so bad. He's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. If he tries to compensate by producing more oil, it just drives the price down some more. And,
one of the criticisms of Putin I've read, and I don't know if it's true, is that he didn't diversify the economy. He spent a lot more time trying to assert control of the oil assets than trying to diversify the economy.
Well, I don't know if I would criticize him too hard for that. You know, when you're dealt lemons, you make lemonade.
Right.
That's,
right.
Yeah, what else did he have to work with? I mean, there's just not a lot else there. You got to. I think it was wise to try and maximize his cash flows from oil while he could, and he should have put it into more productive stuff. But I think the whole system there is so corrupt that it all got siphoned off before it went into productive investment. It all went into Swiss bank accounts or wherever, London mansion.
Cyprus.
Yeah. So it's hard to feel too sorry for Mr. Putin. I mean, he's been presiding over a kleptocracy. The one thing he's got going for him is still is his dwindling military might, which I think he's trying to play that card for all it's worth, in Ukraine, you know, flying planes around Europe, launching missiles, he's saber-rattling over even nuclear weapons now. He is exhibiting the behavior of a desperate man, and I think he is. He's not the cocksure Mr. Macho that the media might portray him to be. I think he's got a very weak hand, and he's had to go basically hat in hand to the Chinese for near-term right. financing. Basically, what he's done some oil and gas deals with the Chinese where he's basically sold them decades worth of oil and gas out into the future in order to get the cash up front. Quick, pay us the money now, and I promise we'll deliver this oil later. And the Chinese are willing to do that because they basically, they've co-opted.
Well, this is good for them. It's bringing the price down.
Yeah, it is. And it is some assurance of supply.
Right.
And the two countries have also signed some currency swap agreements. Now, that's interesting to me because you've had a lot of these bilateral currency swap agreements. Some in the media wring their hands and say, oh, it means that we're going out off the dollar standard for oil, blah, 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 blah. No, I don't think that's what it means. I think what it means is that all of these countries participating in these things see a currency crisis over the horizon here in which they would not be able to convert their own currencies into dollars.
Right.
So they've got to set up these kind of backstop currency swap agreements so there would at least be some availability of tradable currencies for them. This is where things could get really hairy at some point. I don't think the world
right
is in
now,
shape
Jim.
To go through another 2008 kind of disaster.
Yeah, if you look at some of the what's happening in the recession, I mean, I came through Phoenix. I drove from San Francisco over the last week, and I drove through Phoenix, and I was getting off on one of these big interstates where there's, you know, when you get on the intersection above the ramp, there's like 12 corners because you've got medians in the road and, you know, two lanes in each, you know, each road coming in. So you've got like 12 corners. There was a beggar on each corner. It cost me $50 to go through Phoenix. That's how much money I gave out to beggars. And these
got squeezy guys in Phoenix now? Oh, my God.
These were people who were clearly well-educated and attractive, and you could see it on their face. They were scared to death. You know, signs
yeah.
like, I've got two kids to support. And these were people who, you know, clearly didn't have any family or support, and they were just desperate. So.
Yeah. Well, our country has got a whole bunch of problems, and the economics is just one of them. So it's,
well, but if you look at the numbers, I haven't spent any time in Europe over the last year, but if you look at the numbers on unemployment in some of these countries, it's pretty, pretty significant.
Right. Right. And I think that, you know, the only game plan that seems available to any of the global leaders and their central banks is to print more money, you know, avoid deflation at any cost. That's fine until currency crisis strikes. Then everything falls
right.
apart. And that's why I think that is a great unknown, which you don't hear anybody really talking about. Nobody can really get their minds around what it would look like if it happened. But it would just happen one day, and boom, we'd all say, gosh, why didn't we see that coming? Anyway, I think Russia could be in for a lot more hurt on its oil price. It could go down a lot more.
Well, my sense, and I don't know why, there are two things I'm trying to figure out. I don't have it. One is it seems to me that Putin is getting help from different factions in North America. Maybe it's relationships with particular oil companies, but the picture's a little bit more murky than two sovereign nations squabbling is part of it.
I think that's true. I think we really don't want to destroy the guy. We just want him to come around to our way of thinking on things. We could destroy him, but we don't want to do that because he's useful as a foil against the Chinese. The Chinese are really the ultimate bogeyman here.
Right.
And I think that, If not the oil price, there's going to be other economic means brought to bear against them. I think the thinking in Washington is that China is going to topple over on its own. It's going to implode. It's a huge bubble economy that at some point is going to run into a brick wall, and its political system is so brittle that the people are just going to rise up with their pitchforks, and it'll be gone overnight, like the Soviet Union was, maybe.
Really?
I think that's what they're angling for, is another, you know, no guns fired kind of disappearance of a regime there. The Chinese are certainly not going to willingly go that route if they can avoid it. And
right.
So they are shucking and jiving and doing everything they can to mollify their populace and try and clean things up and keep the economy going without overheating. I think they've got problems, but you see them resorting to the same kind of military bluster that Putin is, and raising military tensions all over Asia.
It's an uncomfortable picture, because at some point there's certain kind of squabbling which destroys the economy. So you've got a variety of parties engaged in economic warfare. It sometimes gets very dirty. It certainly can be very expensive. You know, for the people who are trying to engage in productive trade and productive innovation, it can certainly be very harmful and damaging. So it's kind of like you're warring and you're cooperating and competing at the same time. And the question is the competition destroying the fruits of the cooperation or getting in the way of it? It's what it looks like to me. I mean, if you look at what the sanctions, you know, if Russia doesn't buy food from Europe, if you're a farmer in Europe, that's very painful.
It's more painful if you're in Russia and can't get fed your
right.
family.
Right.
I mean, Russian agricultural production has still never recovered from the communist disaster.
Right.
So they still have to import large amounts of meat and grains and all that stuff. That's what finally destroyed the Soviet Union. What I said in the book is that what really killed them is when oil prices dropped, they had to go hat in hand to borrow money from the European banks in order to buy U.S. wheat.
Right.
That's what ultimately forced Gorbachev to throw in a towel. You know, it was game over for them when they couldn't pay back those loans, and the strings attached basically prevented the Soviets from moving troops into Eastern Europe. That was the leverage that we had against them. And when they lost their borders, they lost their country.
As it's funny, over the last month, you know, you had confirmed that you'd be willing to do this interview, and over the last month, I've just every time someone comes out with an interesting excuse on why the price of oil is going down, I just start laughing and wish I was talking to you. So I have to run some of these by.
Okay.
Just as
yeah.
this started, you know, the oil car gears up and switches into the next gear. Suddenly we have all sorts of people coming out and saying, you know, fossil fuels is bad for the world. We need all the universities to divest of oil stocks. I don't know if you saw any of those articles or any of those promotions. All sorts of campaigns online to get universities and everybody to dump their oil stocks. Oh, you know, somebody needs air cover here. It was quite.
Yeah.
It happened just as the price started to go down this summer.
So yeah, there's all kinds of excuses. They say, oh, it's all that fracking that's raising oil production, and you know, the United States definitely, because it's still largely a free economy, it's responded exactly where you'd expect to high oil prices. I mean, okay, the United States uses about, say, 20 million barrels a day of oil. Our production had gotten down to like 7 or 8 million barrels a day. We were importing the rest from Canada, Mexico, the Saudis, wherever. Okay, we're up to about 15 million barrels a day now between higher oil production, plus with all of these fracking wells we've drilled, a lot of it's gas, produces natural gas, but with the gas you get natural gas liquids, which is almost like oil. So when you combine increased oil production, increased gas liquids production, refinery gains and other stuff, we only have to import about 5 million barrels a day anymore. Actually, well, it's more than that maybe in crude. But now we're exporting liquids as well. That's where the big controversy is. Or you got to let us, yeah, it would make sense for the U.S. to export more of this stuff because our refineries actually can't use that much light crude. Better to send it to Canada. Canadian refineries on the East Coast there can use it better than we can, and other places around where it'd be more economically efficient, highest and best use of those hydrocarbons to send them abroad. We'd be net gainers. So, I mean, oil out there. And
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So another one was ISIS is selling oil. Of course, you know me, I have great deep questions about who ISIS really is. I'm figuring they're an affiliate of some defense contractor.
Well, I think so, too. In fact, let's talk about Iraq a little bit because that
okay.
fits into the picture here. But part of the way we kept oil prices high until recently was basically by taking a whole bunch of OPEC-producing countries basically off the order of battle. I mean, we had Libya production completely shut down for a while. Iraq was off the boards for a long time. It's finally come back on, but Iraq is an interesting case study. When Saddam was there, he had firm plans that would have been producing as much oil as the Saudis by this time or before. The Saudis, say, export 10 million barrels a day. He thought he could go from 2 million barrels a day to 10, and he probably could. The Maliki government that was running Iraq after the U.S. left, they had plans to get up to that level, too. And the way they were going to do it was by bringing in foreign investment. Well, what they decided to do was not to actually sell rights to the oil in the ground in the form of equity ownership and production sharing contracts. Instead, Iraq auctioned off service contracts. A service contract basically gives a company maybe a dollar or two a barrel fee to produce the stuff. But then if you want to buy the oil, you got to pay the market price for the oil. You really don't get much of a bargain. Eventually, if you can get the production from some field up above a certain level, then they let you recoup some of the proceeds for your cost recovery. But you got to get the production way up to do that. Well, most American companies didn't want to screw around with that, so Exxon left, others sold out. Chinese came in, took up these contracts. They were happy to get the oil. They thought eventually they'd get their people on the ground and they could make hay. Well, turns out the Chinese companies have invested billions upon billions of dollars in these old oil fields to get them up and running again in Iraq, and they finally are starting to produce some oil. They're just getting to the point where the Chinese might actually recover their costs. And who comes along but ISIS? Who is ISIS? I just can't help but believe various media reports that, in fact, the impetus behind ISIS was the U.S. and the Brits and the Saudis basically funding, arming, training these guys. They fight like real soldiers, and they've done exceptionally
right.
well. They march into Iraq, and they basically force the removal of Maliki. They totally disrupt Iraq's economy, threaten to shut down the oil fields, and they forced Iraq to change its leadership and basically come hat in hand back to the United States. Oh, please, please save us from ISIS, which also, coincidentally, is going after our other enemy, Bashar al-Assad, in Syria. Do they go after Jordan or Israel or Turkey? No. Coincidence, you know.
Right.
They go after the Kurds a little bit. We like the Kurds, so when they go after the Kurds, we bomb them.
Right.
And stop them. But other than that, ISIS is doing, we couldn't pay these guys to do a better job than they've been doing going after our enemies. So,
every time I see pictures of them in the desert wearing black gloves, I say, you know, maybe nobody wants to see the Toledo, Ohio skin color.
Really? And you see them, they drive around in these caravans of brand new Toyota pickup trucks. You know, where did those come from? It's
somewhere in there. This has to be good for defense spending, because you know all the defense contractors are telling investors, don't worry about the budget, don't worry about sequestration, you know, we'll make up for it with foreign sales.
Yeah, right. But my point is, Iraq has basically been put in upheaval, and all those Chinese investments are seriously at risk now. And what the Chinese thought was going to be their client state in Iraq ain't no more. So the Chinese, yeah, they buy a lot of oil from Iraq, but they pay top dollar for that, and they have to ship it halfway around the world. So the Chinese are basically no more ahead of the game than they were before. In fact, Chinese oil policy has been a consummate disaster here. The country had encouraged its oil companies to go out and buy up oil reserves all over the place, foreign oil reserves, to develop them and own them and ship the oil back. But they've squandered untold gazillions of dollars buying doggy properties in the wrong places, landlocked, unable to get the stuff out of the ground or into a market, let alone back to China. So these companies have taken, ought to take, huge big write-offs on a lot of this stuff. And in fact, they've squelched their whole overseas acquisition strategy. They've been trying to put the money back into Chinese oil production, which is difficult. It's just not a very good oil province. So,
Now let's turn a little bit to U.S. manufacturing, because lower energy costs is going to be good for U.S. manufacturing, no?
Yeah, not to mention gasoline's under $3 a gallon. I'm going to go buy a pickup truck.
I went and bought gas on the way home, and it was below $3, and I almost, you know,
yay!
I almost thought it was the, you know, the machine was broken. There was a mistake.
Yeah.
So, but talk a little bit about manufacturing, because there's no doubt that the increased domestic supply and the, particularly the lower gas prices, has really been a boon for U.S. manufacturing.
Yeah, I think that's true, and particularly natural gas prices. If natural gas was priced on a oil equivalent basis, it would be three or four times as expensive as it is. But we've managed to keep this bifurcated market in which liquid hydrocarbons get to trade at phenomenally high prices per BTU. Natural gas is like, it's really cheap. Natural gas is, I think, now is actually the single biggest cost element for American manufacturing. Energy generally is the biggest cost, single cost component in U.S. manufacturing, far more than labor.
Right.
And of that energy cost, it's one way or another, it ends up being natural gas. I guess electricity is in there too, but even a lot of that is natural gas fired. So natural gas is a huge leg up for the United States manufacturing economy, and this is why you're seeing actual migration of manufacturing jobs back to the United States from China and other places, because Chinese costs are much higher, and their labor costs are going up faster than the U.S. And the U.S. just has more productivity, so better to stay at home, especially if you see protectionism rearing its head somehow. Better to stay in your home market than try to build abroad and export it back into the U.S.
Now, it looks to me, you know, all reports are and have been for a while, Jim, that the weather this year, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, is going to be pretty cold.
Right.
Is that going to have an impact on prices? Ditto if it happens in Russia and the Ukraine?
Well, yeah, but again, there's plenty of oil and gas. Cold will certainly affect prices at the margin. The NYMEX is a much bigger factor in the pricing, though.
Right.
And so you've had, even fuel oil prices in New York have come down a lot. And I expect they'll come down some more, too. They'll still be expensive. But I think fuel in the United States is going to be affordable. And there'll be plenty of it.
Now, the other thing that happens is every time the oil price runs up, you see the renewables business kind of gear up and all sorts of interest growing in renewables. And then the oil price runs down and it gets kind of disassembled. You know, it's kind of like Heartbreak Hill.
Yeah, well, a lot of it should be, because a lot of it was just never really economic to begin with.
Right.
A lot of these wind projects, I just noticed there's a bunch of, well, there's been failures in the solar photovoltaic industry. There's, financial distress in the wind energy. A lot of these schemes were never really economic on their own anyway. They all depended on huge subsidy deals. And, you know, if electricity gets cheaper, it's just not going to work. I'm bemused by all these reports about, you know, thousands of idle giant windmills in California and elsewhere that just aren't even worth fixing.
Really?
Because the cost of going up there, taking them down and putting a new generator in them, it's just not worth the cost, so they just sit there idle. And I think that's, you're going to see more of that. It's just,
My understanding is the price of solar continues to come down, and so at some point, you know, we could get to the point where solar could be competitive with coal. We're not there yet, but it's getting closer.
Well, I'm thinking of building a house in a very northern state, and I'm definitely going to put in a solar photovoltaic system, partly because the utility rules in that place require the utility to be your battery. You can generate power in the summer, run your meter backwards, and then take it out in the winter and kind of negate your electric bill. So that makes a lot of sense. And I think you'll see a lot more of that.
Yeah. Okay. So every week we do Let's Go to the Movies, and I recommend a movie. And this week I was going to I've recommended that we watch The Prize. It was a documentary made from Juergen's book. And since you brought up the book, I thought you might just have you seen the documentary?
No, I haven't seen that.
Uh-huh.
I don't have a TV. I blush to admit.
I don't have a TV either, but I have one of those little DVD players that you know, so I watch all my stuff for the Salieri Report on the DVD player. Well, what do you think is going to happen? So currency war to trade war to war, what do we think the risks of war are?
Well, I would have given it odds of slim to none maybe 6 months ago. But, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. When you hear Putin and people like that openly alluding to their nuclear weapons capabilities, vis-a-vis NATO, I mean, there's no place for that kind of talk unless somebody's actually thinking about this stuff. And clearly, the posturing around the Asiatic Rim between Japan and China, the other Asian nations, I think China has opened up a can of worms here that is going to result in significant militarization all over that region. And when you get military assets floating around bumping into each other, you know, the possibilities for miscalculation rise geometrically. So it's not good.
Well, just sitting back and looking at it, looks to me like a decision has been made to bust Putin by any means necessary. But it seems to me that that can be done with oil. You don't need military action to do it.
Well, that's right. Now, they never specifically say oil. If you listen to the wording on all these sanctions, well, we'll go after their energy sector. They don't want to say oil. Washington will never admit we're manipulating oil prices.
Right, they
absolutely
can't.
Not. They can't give away the story. Well, I think everybody in the know knows what's going on there. They go after their oil companies. They'll go after the oil oligarchs. They'll go after all those guys. But you can see it's a staged, graduated state of economic warfare. And Putin can see that the longer he lets this go on, the more likely it is we're going to go after his bread and butter, which is that oil price. And you're seeing it in spades right now. That's why I'm saying this price could go way south, before it stabilizes.
And if they take oil way south, what do you think happens to gas?
Gasoline prices, you mean?
No.
Or
natural gas.
Natural gas, again, it kind of trades on its own equilibrium basis. I think there's plenty of gas. I think those prices will probably stay pretty stable. There's really not a lot of substitution of natural gas to oil or vice versa.
Right.
So I think gas could remain relatively stable.
Okay, so the bifurcation stays. And what about Arctic drilling? If this fight continues to stay bitter, get more bitter, does a lot of the Arctic drilling deals that Putin's made get changed?
Oh, they've already fallen apart. Exxon has already pulled out pretty much of their Arctic drilling deal. And without Western companies, the technology and the money, Russian companies really don't have the stuff to go do anything with it. Even if they found oil up there, it'd be decades before they could get it to a market. So what's the point? I think it's just going to go nowhere.
Okay. So that means, because Arctic drilling could have significantly increased their reserves, couldn't it?
Russia has already got so much oil in the ground. This is my point. They could be producing twice as much as they do now just by drilling more wells and fields they already know about. They don't have to find any more reserves.
Right.
Their problem, like the industry's whole problem, is how to keep this up in the ground, to keep the price up.
Right.
So.
So how does all this, does any of the climate change stuff, relate to the oil card trying to?
Well, one point I make in there is that these kind of economic warfare policies, they never go anywhere without a thick bodyguard of lies. to paraphrase Churchill.
This is why we love you, Jim Norman.
Well, you know, back in the
80s, bodyguard of lies.
there was a whole array of propaganda tools that were rolled out to kind of spread. For instance, and you're starting to hear some of it now, the Saudis are reducing their prices in order to maintain their market share. Now, see, remember, that was the same line that was used back in the 80s to justify the Saudis dropping their price. In fact, Washington had been arm-twisting the Saudis to cut their price, and they actually went to what was called net-back pricing, in which the Saudis said, we'll match anybody else's price. But that was just to let the oil price fall in free fall, pushed down by short trading on the NYMEX back then. So you're setting a similar stage up here for, rationalizing why the oil price could just fall out of bed here. But the global warming thing, that was actually, I've always thought the science behind it was so suspect, if not bogus, that it just smacked of propaganda and actual almost a cult type brainwashing process. But the purpose, I think, was aimed at China to basically force them to increase their manufacturing costs by using cleaner fuels, stop burning coal, clean up their act, and build their
cost. They have a terrible pollution problem. There's no doubt about it. They have a terrible pollution problem.
Yeah, and I think they're smart. They'll fix that on their own, which I think is what they're saying. They kind of did this sleeves out of your vest kind of a deal with Obama to promise to clean up their act in the next 30 years or something like that. So I think even the Chinese realize they need to clean up their act. But global warming, not from CO2. No way is it from CO2. I think that we're in
But I was wondering to what extent they're using that as something to help with the engineering of the sort of energy management. To me, there are bigger games afoot there. I have to ask you about Keystone, because now that the Republicans have won, how are they going to shut off that supply?
Well, I don't think Keystone really matters that much. That was just kind of a political football. I mean, I guess they're voting tonight on this. The Democrats actually want to approve the thing now, I think, partly to help out Mary Landrieu get reelected. But, you know, Keystone, I mean, oil markets, well, first of all, it's a much safer way to move crude than hauling it in rail cars, number one. So environmentally, there's no grounds for all these environmental objections to Keystone. It just, they make no sense.
The well, except if you're a rancher and it's coming over in your property and you don't want it to, that's, you know.
Or you don't want the rental payments for that?
Right.
I bet any rancher would probably beg, please put your pipeline on my land, will you? No, I think the real reason that the U.S. opposed that for so many years, when we were pushing the oil price up, was that if you actually brought 830,000 barrels a day of Canadian crude to the Gulf Coast and dumped it on the refining center down there, you'd have a hard time finding a home for it, and it would hurt the price. And then you'd have to put even more money into the NYMEX to counteract that some way. So it was just a problem from a pricing,
an oil card
perspective, geopolitical
pricing. It's just going to make your management that much more difficult.
Right. So who needs that? Let's just leave the oil there for a while, you know, and we'll build it when we need it and want it, which may be now. I think now it's the perfect time to let that thing go through. Get it built in a year. You've got, you know, and you're telling Putin that oil prices are going to be low for a long time. So get used to it.
Right. You think it makes a difference that the Republicans now control the Senate?
Well, now you're getting into politics. My view is it's Tweedledee, Tweedledum. I don't think there's that much of a difference between either of these parties. And the reason is because we live in a national security state. Let's face it. You know, I mean, all these guys basically do what they're told to do, and they're given a little sandbox on the side where they can kind of mess around with their own little pet stuff, but they really, I don't think, have any substantive control over the underlying direction and priorities of the permanent government.
Right.
That's a cynical view, but... And
when I worked in Washington, there used to be something called the Secretary's Discretionary Fund, or sometimes we call it the Secretary's Discretionary Budget. That was a little pile of money where he could pretty much do what he wanted, and everything else was he did what he was told.
Right. So imagine a government in which the national security establishment controls 80% of all the money and gives the visible part of the government 20% to play with just to go away and leave it alone.
Right.
What you got. Actually, there was a book written by a Tufts University professor that basically said exactly that. Vote all you want. It's not going to do any good. Either party.
Right.
I mean, the die is cast here. What troubles me particularly, though, is that the electoral process itself has been so fatally compromised and corrupted. I mean, the only candidates we are even given a look at, let alone get on the ballot, are people who have either sold their soul to this establishment or are so controlled by it and carefully vetted, groomed, trained, coached, that's all you're ever going to get. And that's all we've had for, I would say, the last 20 years.
But I would make a plug for local elections. There's still some wiggle room.
I still vote. I still vote in my local elections. None of them ever win, but I vote.
Oh, we had a great campaign here for sheriff a couple of years ago, and the good guy won. It was fantastic.
Good. Good.
The whole county, all the, you know, all the hardworking citizens pulled together and said, no. It was great.
Good.
Yeah,
I think that does happen at the margin. But at the national level, in the nuclear age, things aren't left to chance.
Right. They can't.
Right.
Right. So they can't. So I'll never forget. I don't know if you read. There's a great book on the history of Bechtel and the that one of the things I've gone back recently and looked is the history of Dwight Eisenhower. The more I learn about him, the more I like him. But there's one confrontation between him. I'll tell you two stories. One confrontation between him and one of the Bechtels came in and said that he ought to approve Bechtel owning a nuclear weapon. And, you know, the story sounds strange, but if you've ever been a regulator and dealt with outrageous demands from the private sector, I believe that story. But my favorite one is after he authorized the existence of Area 51, he had, under the authorities used to set up Area 51, the CIA was responsible for security. And I would argue, as time went by, more and more for financing. Anyway, but he wasn't getting regular reports, and he got very frustrated, and finally he called up the guy at the CIA and told him that if he didn't get in his office the next day and give him a full report, that he was going to fly to Colorado, get the First Army, and invade Area 51.
He'd have to. That's the only way he'd find out what was going on. No,
and
I think,
since then, we've never let a general become president.
Right.
Yeah, anyway.
Well,
but you're right. If you look at I think that one of the reasons I really recommend, if you haven't read Jim's book, The Oil Card, the reason I recommend it is you need to understand that we're dealing with leadership which is subject to national security concerns and cannot possibly disclose. You know, the more they disclose about what they're doing and why they're doing it, the more it compromises the effectiveness of what they're doing.
Which is why I think the highest elected officials of the country don't even know what's going on. They don't have a high enough security clearance for this.
Right.
President of the United States, your security clearance only goes about halfway up the chain of command.
Right.
There's much bigger fish being fried here than what you see on the nightly news.
Right. And I would also say that the risks they're managing are much more dangerous than people, you know, sort of many people who haven't been in that position appreciate.
I think that's true.
Yeah, it's not so easy being in their shoes. So it's a, you know, sort of the game they're dealing with is a brutal game.
Right. This is why I think Putin's behavior is very telling, because I think he knows the vulnerabilities there. He knows the buttons to push, and he's going to go push them.
Right.
Yeah.
It was funny. Unfortunately, some allies of mine came up the other day with they came out with a video saying, good news, there are a wonderful group of Asian families, the Dragon Elders, who are the wealthiest families in the world, and they're going to come save us all. The dollar's going to drop to nothing, and we're going to get capitalized by their gold, and everything's going to turn out okay. And you listen to this and you think, what would happen? So I'll just ask you, what would happen if we ever turned control over to a group of Asian families? What would happen to the United States and the American people?
Well, it would just never happen that way. I mean, if we did, it wouldn't look that way.
Right.
You wouldn't, maybe we already did, and we don't even know. there are some conspiracy folks who might even argue that. But,
I don't know, that's in complete defiance of any, you know, if you look at all my different experiences of reality, whether Washington, Wall Street, markets, anything, you know, there's nothing. If you're a group of Asian wealthy families, why would you have not taken care of the pollution and the brutal poverty within your own sphere? Why would you instead use your money to bail out a group of American consumers who've enjoyed a false prosperity financed with the hard labor of millions of Chinese?
Well,
I
think that the guys in Beijing have to worry about this a lot more than we do. I think they're the ones who are at severe risk of basically the old Chinese warlord set.
Yes.
They're tapping them on the shoulder saying, time's up, goodbye.
Right.
And they would just have to head for the hills.
Right.
Because it's such a tiny corrupt elite that runs that country, they could not withstand a general popular uprising. The army just would not be with them. So I think it is a very fragile system. And I think the United States would be happy to just have the country run again by a group of families the way it was for hundreds of years.
Oh, that wouldn't surprise me at all. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. I think it's tricky business because no matter how difficult it is to keep this group of people in North America employed, keeping the Chinese employed is a much trickier business.
Yeah. Well, see, this to me, this is the biggest flaw of the whole U.S. economic warfare strategy. I think that guys in Washington have persuaded themselves, oh, yeah, we can topple governments bloodlessly just by pushing some economic levers here. Hey, life is not that neat and tidy. Right? Things always go wrong. Things get out of hand. People get desperate. They make desperate decisions. And you're playing with fire here. It's just playing with fire. When you see these gyrations in the oil price, somebody's playing with fire.
Right. Right, because each time you swing, you destroy lots of lives and businesses. I'll just close on one note. I was listening on the way back over the last week. I was listening to a series of CDs that describe the history of nuclear testing at the Nevada test site. And one of the things they discussed was several tests where the scientists knew that it could seriously harm the ionosphere. And you're listening to this thing and you're thinking, why would anybody risk this? I don't get it. And so I think sometimes, you know, the national security state takes risks that are hard to fathom.
Well, they are. And I go back to this book by this Tufts University professor. You know, I apologize, I can't remember the name of the book or the author's name, but his point is, who is this national security establishment? His argument is, well, it's a bunch of good people who are all in their little, you know, honeycomb beehive doing their thing, trying to do good. Now, is evidence for that? I don't know. I think that's more wishful thinking than anything. I mean, it's a nice idea. Maybe it's true. But even if it's true, all these people busily working away for the common good somewhere, you can end up with horrendously bad outcomes.
Right.
And theoretically, democracy is supposed to check and balance that, but we don't really have that anymore. It's
well, here's the thing that I think.
Propagandized outcome.
Yeah, what I think really checkmates it is not just democracy, but markets. You know, markets allow people
right.
to communicate. Markets allow healthy kind of cooperation and competition to go on. You know, we get
right.
a lot of our aggression out in the markets. And what's amazing is globally in almost every society, you know, one thing that's funny is everybody says, well, you know, he won. You know, Jack Ma did it, so he won, and that's okay. So markets can vent a lot of this, and one of the challenges of having, you know, prices no longer communicate a useful number in a market, you know, to engage in economic warfare, you corrupt price. And when you corrupt price, you corrupt communication. When you corrupt communication, then you don't have a healthy way of, you know, cooperating and competing, and I think that can get very
right.
dangerous. So
that's right. That's right. In fact, I think that is the real desultory conclusion of the book, The Oil Card. When you get done reading it, you realize, oh, my God, if the oil market has been jacked around this way decade after decade, what have they done to the bond market? What have they done
right.
to the stock market?
Right.
And so many other markets. Is there any market you can trust anymore? Could you ever trust them?
Right.
But, you know, the whole free market mantra that we have grown up with is really...
out the window.
It's out the window. Yeah.
Yeah, it's out the window.
And even if markets are working, you can't believe it.
Right.
So...
right. It's a very managed... it's a very managed market. So
yeah.
Anyway, well, Jim, the oil card. We can get it at your website. We can get it on all the usual
stuff. It's on
suspects.
Amazon. Yeah. I think we're almost sold out of it, but you can always get an ebook copy of it.
Okay, good. Good. Okay, well, you know, I've got to make my plug. We need you to write another one.
My publisher says that, too, one of these days, right?
Okay, well, Jim Norman, you're the best. So
Thanks.
I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Salera Report. You have a great evening, and keep us posted. If you got anything to say, we'll get you back on, okay?
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Kevin.
Thank you.